You're listening to a Prairie Punk House Companion right here on the Prairie Punk Press Network.
The views expressed by any host or any guest on the Prairie Punk House Companion are the personal views or opinions of the people who express them and do not reflect the views or opinions of anyone else on the show or any company, employer, or any other organization that the individual expressing them has or will affiliate with in the past, present, or future. Hey everybody, you're listening to a Prairie Punk House Companion. We are now on episode 19, and my name is Neckbone.
Hi, I'm Jerbear. I'm getting a haircut tomorrow.
That's the quip you came up with?
Shut your fucking mouth.
It's probably not your worst one, so.
You're my worst one.
That's doesn't make any sense. That's okay though. That's all right. You can bring it back. You can bring it back later in the episode.
Shut up. All right. Yeah, episode 19, huh? That's wild.
Yeah.
We have our friend with us today. Her name is Nicole, and she lived at the Pirate House. And I just discovered from her before we started recording that she did not grow up in Lawrence like I thought she did. So, Nicole, why don't you tell us some about you and how you came to Lawrence and how you got into punk rock?
Hey, everybody. Yeah, for sure. Where did I leave us off? Well, I moved to Lawrence when I was 15, but I was just explaining to you guys a minute ago how both sides of my family, on my mom's and dad's side, both have roots in Kansas, but my dad's Canadian and my mom's American. And I was born in Central Illinois near the University of Illinois, where my dad did his PhD, and went to school in very rural backwater Illinois for the first 15 years of my life. And then when I was 15, my mom and I moved back to her family farm, which was south of Lawrence. Her parents taught at KU in the science department. And they were getting up in their years, and we were looking for a fresh start. So in the middle of high school, I moved to Lawrence and, started hanging out at the Pirate House, started going to Lawrence High. And I guess I should just say, like, I was interested in punk before this, but I had never met punks before coming to Lawrence, if that makes any sense. So like I come from a big blended family, and on my Canadian side, I spent time going to school in Vancouver, British Columbia, and where I, you know, had older siblings, and my big sister Tashi was like a skater punk, and my older brother was like a drummer. So like I think around the time that I'm like 10 or 11, like I'm listening to punk music and like really like identifying with punk music. And then, so the internet helped with that. Living in nowhere, Illinois, and having the internet wasn't so bad. I can't even imagine what it would have been like being there without the internet, but like getting into music through the internet at the time. And then, yeah, coming to Lawrence, it was like, holy shit, there are actual punks here. Like, maybe I can go to a punk show or like join a punk band or something like that. Yeah. I still remember like coming to town. We came through town and like I saw the Bottleneck. I'm like, oh, cool. There's going to be like shows here and stuff. But it was like a couple of weeks coming into town. I'm like 15. I'm in the checkout aisle at Target with my mom. And these two kids run through like the checkout next to me. And I notice one of them has a back patch for like kid Dynamite. I was like, oh, there's punks in this town. Like, actually, there's going to be like punk shows to go to. This is going to be really fun. So, yeah, so that's kind of like how it got started. And I also feel like super blessed that I was at a high school where like there were a lot of punks at my high school. It's like really like bizarre to think about now, but there were like punks and anarchists at my high school. And so we would like hang out at school and then like go over to the Pirate House for potlucks or shows or whatever. I mean, it was pretty cool. Within a couple of months of moving to town, it was like a lot of stuff seemed to be going on with the punk scene. So
what year was that?
So, gosh, we moved January of 2000, I want to say.
So yeah. Did you go to school with Mike Hedstrom then?
I did. Yeah. Okay, I actually have a note about that. I have a note about that, which is not only were there...
with Justin and I for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, not only were there like punks in my school, but there were crust punks in my school. And there were three of us who were crust punks who played string classical instruments. And Mike Hedstrom was one. And I played cello and Zeke played violin. I don't know if you guys remember Zeke.
Zeke who lost his foot?
Oh, I have a story about that too.
Yeah. We had a story about that on one of the episodes. Was that, or was
Did
that?
Did you already talk podcast? About one-footed Zeke?
Very briefly. Bit. Yeah.
Okay. I'll add to the oral history here. I'll tell you what I know.
I ran into him randomly when I lived in Norfolk, Virginia. It took a while to register because he looked out of place in Norfolk, Virginia, but I was like, oh shit, that's odd.
Oh man, this is going on a tangent that's like way off course about one-footed Zeke, but I like ran into somebody in, I want to say Olympia, Washington, who was from Lawrence, and they were like, yo, did you hear about one-footed Zeke? I'm like, no, what? Zeke lost his foot? And then like, the more I tried to trace it back, the more I got the story back to somebody who was like, no, it was a different Zeke. Would there be two punk Zekes at the same time? Like, I don't know. But the story goes that he kept it in a bucket of formaldehyde, and the mm-hmm. bucket continued to have things added to it. Like at punk shows, people would make offerings. So at the end, like by the end, the bucket had like a My Little Pony doll and like some change, like some loose change in it. And oh yeah, and you could pay like 50 cents or like the change in your pocket to see the foot.
Nice.
I don't know if if you can confirm or deny this information.
I think it was Joe that was talking about it, and he confirmed that it was Zeke, and that he kept it in a jar and scared kids with it.
Yes. And that he took it out to play soccer with it, and the cops rolled up on him. Because they couldn't tell, because he had his fake leg on, so they couldn't tell that he only had one leg, because he had like long pants, and they just thought that he had a severed foot. And
ooh. Well, I mean, he did.
Yeah. So they confirmed it was his. And they're like, okay, well, we don't really know what to do with this, so they just left, I guess.
That's the okay thing about Lawrence cops, I suppose.
I mean, compared to cops in other places, sure.
Yeah.
Have you heard about cops here in Chicago?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, do you get any don't do it again in Chicago.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'll warn if Zeke ever comes through, I'll be like, yeah, don't play soccer with your foot here. The cops aren't as friendly.
I mean, it's been 20 years.
I mean, it's pickled. So
maybe that's something that like another podcast guest can contribute to. Like maybe we can keep the journey of the foot going and you can find out what happened because somebody knows something. That's what I'm thinking.
We call it a foot race to the truth.
I mean I can check in with the Norfolk punks and see if he's still there. He could be.
There you go.
I mean that was a while ago. That was like 10 years ago at this point, but
I wonder if Ty knows him. He knows
probably
everybody.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
This is your entry into the true crime podcast market. Yeah. Okay,
there was that whole Canadian feet washing up on the shore thing back in 08 or whatever.
Oh yeah. That does happen here.
Is that a thing that's known about Canada?
Have you not heard about that?
No.
Does it happen like more in Canada? Span.
I mean, considering the population difference between Canada and the United States, it should happen significantly less in Canada, I would think, unless the feet are coming from the United States. It's just washing.
I think it was all on the West Coast, if that makes a difference. I think it's more populated maybe than like.
I mean, in Vancouver, it is. Once you leave Vancouver, it's just like empty. It's like five people north of there. 10 if you count Alaska.
Well, you should look.
I'll have to. I got to take issue with it because that's where like half of my family lives now. Is in northern British Columbia. So it's funny you say that.
Yeah.
Is that what brought you up to Canada after you left Kansas?
So my dad's side of the family moved to Vancouver when I was still young. He took a teaching position at the University of British Columbia, and then the family ended up moving farther north to a place called Smithers, which is like a town of 9,000 people. Like it's quite small, ski town, tourism, etc. I moved back to Vancouver when I was 18 for undergrad. So that was like where I went. When people ask, they're like, why did you move? I'm like, do you remember what was happening in America in 2003? Like,
right.
I remember like the war on terror starting and like Bush. And I was just like, man, I'm going to get the fuck out of here. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to go spend some time somewhere else. And no, I mean, practically speaking, because I had Canadian citizenship, like I have access to Canadian healthcare. Mm-hmm. Like there were reasons why I did want to move up there, but that was what was going on around that time. It's 2003. So I was in Lawrence from 2000 to 2003, which is just not that much time, and yet so much mm-hmm. happened in there.
Yeah. Was there any kind of culture shock moving from tiny Illinois town to a college town with lots of punk rockers?
A bustling metropolis of 90,000 people.
I didn't think it was 90 then. I think it was like 60.
Yeah, it was like 70. It's like 90 now.
Yeah, those numbers sound ballpark right. For it was like people described it as like 80,000, and it would fluctuate with the school year. But yeah, no, I like rural Illinois. Like I went to a school that was kindergarten through grade 8, and it was 120 students. The population of the town was like 120.
Oh, shit.
What town was that?
So that's called Ludlow, Illinois. And that's like 40 minutes north of Champaign-Urbana, which is in the center of the state.
Oh, yeah.
Where the university is.
Very familiar with Champaign-Urbana. I wish I
were. Are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
My wife was just up there for work.
I was going to say it was a terrible place to grow up, but it's way cooler now. I don't know if y'all have been there in the last like 10, 15 years, but they've got like a bunch of radicals took over the post office downtown. They bought it for like a dollar, and they turned it into this thing called IMC, the Independent Media Center. You guys remember Indie Media? They like still use the Indie Media logo. I remember I came in like 2015, 2016, I'm like, oh my God, like is Indie Media still here? Like, is this, did the war on terror not happen here? Anyways, so like they've been able to keep a ton of stuff going in the last two decades. They've got the largest books to prisoners program in all of the Midwest in their basement. They've got like a massive bike library, lending library. They do so many cool things. But anyways, when I went there as an adult, I was like, oh man, none of this was here when I was a kid. This was a fucking miserable place to grow up. So yeah, there wasn't.
Are you talking about Ludlow or Champaign?
Champaign. Okay. I mean, big town was.
I was going to be like, if that was Ludlow, right. I was about to be very impressed by Ludlow.
No, Ludlow was like 140 people. not even a bar. Like you really imagine like destitute, like like people talk about like the forgotten rural heartland.
Oh
like,
yes, we call that region of Illinois is called Forgottonia. It's a fake country called Forgottonia, which just is forgotten. And then
how it feels. That's really how it feels. Like I went to high school in Rantoul, which was where there was a decommissioned Air Force base in 1991, and the town has just sort of been in slow decline ever since. Like the year that I left, which was my sophomore year, there was a referendum in the town to save money. They were going to remove all of the extracurricular activities in the high school except for sports. So I was like, oh, so I mean, fuck it. I guess it's, Yeah, it's like, I guess it's great that I'm leaving, since fucking orchestra, fucking theater, like everything I was a part of is like about to get shut down in this school. And
that was in 2000? That's crazy.
That was 99. Yeah.
99,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Right before. And so, yeah, so I moved to LHS in midway through the year, January of 2000. And yeah, things were pretty interesting. I had a couple of notes from that time, because I feel like there's kind of like the before time and then the after time. Like, so there was a group called ASA, Alliance for Social Awareness, that I like started going to their meetings. It was like hosted by the philosophy teacher, Jeanette. I still am friends with her. She's lovely. I remember like multiple times we're in the philosophy room and she's like, hey, have you guys ever heard of this guy Foucault? Do you guys want to watch a Foucault video on the computer? And she would play, I think it's like, it wasn't a Foucault interview. It's the Noam Chomsky video with him like talking with Guy Debord. And she just thought this was amazing. So like, imagine this is like playing in the background. There's like hippie and anarchist kids all hanging out. And we get a presentation from like some grownups who came in to tell us about a convergence that was happening against the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which we all remember that. And in that crew was Alicia, Chris Kellogg, and somebody else who I don't remember. But I remember just thinking like, oh wow, like these guys are like cool. They're like real like organizers. Like I wanna go and check out whatever it is they're working on. And yeah, there was like a convergence in Kansas City. I think that was like the first time I saw Short Bus Kids play, was at the convergence there. And then like a year later, September 11th happened and the globalization movement was over. And then all of a sudden everything was like war and patriotism and flags fucking everywhere. But yeah. I remember that first,
so weird.
That first year was just like, oh wow, there's like a lot of anti-globalization organizing happening here. Actually, I don't know if you guys remember this, but this also happened in that time. Ralph Nader came through town. He was like speaking. And of course, because Ralph Nader's there, the Westboro Baptist Church is also there.
Of course. I mean, they tell us anything.
how we're all gay, which you know, all of us are like, all right. But there was a guy there, and I think he was the guy that got referenced in a previous episode where he was like, his whole thing was kind of like a performance art that like complimented the Westboro guys. Mm-hmm. So like we're all standing in line waiting to get in to see Ralph Nader, and like Westboro Baptist Church is right over here, and this guy is running around in people's face about how we need to kill all the humpback whales. And how every year dozens of people are killed by humpback whales, and it's intolerable. Mm-hmm. And he just like was so in his character.
Mm-hmm. Got to nuke something.
It was just like such an incredible compliment to what was otherwise like a super fucking depressing row of homophobes. I don't know. I don't know like if people can really grasp what that was like being around those guys.
It was before they turned their ire to soldiers. So it wasn't,
right.
You know, it got publicity, but nobody cared because they were just picking on queer folk. So it was just like, yeah, these people are crazy.
It was after
September 11th when they started going after soldiers. But,
right.
You know, I always wanted to troll them by making out with dudes in front of their protests.
I think that did happen.
I don't know if you remember me telling about the when they protested in front of the Domino's that I worked at on 9th and Iowa.
That's what I was thinking of.
There were some guys there that were making out, and some women too. And then of course there was the guy who was running around. I think if I remember right, he was wearing like a chicken suit.
Yeah. I mean, that just sounds like a party. It's like guys and gals making out, guy in a chicken suit.
I was just like, I was pizza? Pissed because I ran outside and I got to be part of it for a little while, but I was working. I was like, shit, I'm on the clock. Damn it. gotta make that 5:15 an hour.
Oh my god, yeah. I think that was around the time that I had my first job, and it was 5:50
at
Papa Kino's. Yeah.
Oh nice.
Okay, I'm going to segue here with the pizza and ask you guys, do you guys remember Gumby's Pizza? Am I remembering the name right?
Yep.
So I feel like I have to bring up like the role that Gumby's Pizza played in like feeding people at the Pirate House. Like I not necessarily going to name names, but you know, like because it's a vegetarian, you know, place, but like also like maybe people don't feel like having vegetables. It was just like all cheese pizza all the time.
Yeah.
And like those on the back of each of the pizza boxes, there was like a coupon where it said like collect 10 of these and you get a free pizza. So we're just always fucking greasy pizza boxes like all over the house, or like half cut out, half like ripped out, like a little pile on the counter. And it's just kind of like, oh, well, if anybody needs something to eat, there's like, looks like about eight Gumby's Pizza tokens.
Maybe you can get yourself.
My favorite was when they were vegan and
that must have been
with
no cheese
sauce. I think they just got fucking sauce. Bread, on
it was just bread and sauce. I mean, you can just get breadsticks and sauce at that point. That's just all that is.
Yeah.
Damn. But I, you know, for a group of vegans and vegetarians, I have never seen that many vegans and vegetarians that afraid of vegetables. I don't think a single vegetable graced that house. I think I ate more vegetables than they did. And I was a carnivore. And I think I was like, man, I ate more vegetables than you fuckers do. Jesus Christ. Put some green on that plate. You're going to die.
Yeah. I remember one of the first days I went over to the Pirate House, like somebody was complaining about the compost in the back and how like you can't just throw organic waste into a big pile behind your deck.
Right.
You have that attitude.
But somebody was like, there were whole onions out there. It just smells really bad. It just attracts rats. What are you guys doing? We're trying hard. They were trying hard.
It's true. Yeah. You were a lot more political than we were and into the activism side in Lawrence more than we were. How is that just because you went to school with a bunch of anarchists, or was it the Pirate House that got you into that? Because like I said, at that point, neither of us were political. I mean, we were.
No. I called myself an anarchist, but I didn't know what that meant. I wasn't reading theory. I was just making circle A's and being like, I like chaos. Like that was just like, there was no political meaning behind it. In fact, I was pretty actively and overtly apolitical at the same time. So it just didn't, those two things didn't mesh. I just didn't understand why at that point.
Yeah. I considered myself a leftist, but I wasn't doing activism because activists had pissed me off by being too, hoity-toity about their activism versus my activism.
Well, it's a good thing that leftists aren't hoity-toity anymore. I was interested in politics before moving to Lawrence. It's funny that you guys mentioned you were going off like about problematic bands, and then at the end you were like, let's talk about some bands that suck but their politics are great, and you mentioned Rage Against the Machine, and I'm like, I know that Rage is like a little cringe sometimes, but I loved Rage Against the Machine when I was like 12-13 years old, and I read all the liner notes, and I got like interested in pretty much anything they were talking about. So like I learned about the Zapatistas from them, learned about like just like American history, and like got ideas for books to read from their liner notes and stuff. So by the time I moved to Lawrence, actually I was like, no, I'm an anarchist. Like I'd read about the Spanish Civil War and I was like, I'm that. And I was like interested in like Black and Indigenous liberation stuff. But I don't think I like maybe exclusively called myself an anarchist until I moved to Lawrence, and it became like pretty defined. Like, you know, we had the anarchist gathering, and like there were anarchist reading groups and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, definitely like I felt like the game changer in Lawrence was that it was like, oh, these are other anarchists or other leftists. Like we can do stuff together. Like we can organize stuff together. It doesn't just need to be about like reading this or that thing. We could like we could make projects and do stuff. And like, it was incredible seeing what kinds of stuff people came up with. Like sometimes it would turn into like a reading group or a discussion group. Other times people would just like do stuff that I think we now think of as like part of the anarchist tradition. Like I'm thinking about, I was at a show once and like my friend Jess, who worked at the print shop down on Iowa, showed up at the show with like a stack of photocopied copies of Evasion. Do you guys remember the Evasion zine that came out from Crime Think? It's like all about like the like this one guy basically like trying to live outside the system, which is hilarious because like the whole zine is just about him like dumpstering Oreos and stuff and just being like, these are vegan, you can eat these, they're vegan. So like, yeah, the idea of like you're evading what like capitalist culpability by eating out of dumpsters all the time. Like it's very of the moment, the zine, but it was so rad, like going to a show and it's just like, oh, you're like handing out this like subversive text that you photocopied at your minimum wage job. And now we're all reading this thing. You know, like I felt like that kind of stuff would happen, you know? And yeah, it was great. I would even put like the dance parties in that category too. Like when there were impromptu dance parties in the streets or
Critical Mass.
Oh yeah, Critical Mass. I didn't even have that on my list. But yeah, so I think it started out with, I heard from some kids at school that there was like a Food Not Bombs. And so we started going to the Food Not Bombs together. But then like also, in the group of like Food Not Bombs high school students was like also the weird art kids who were like a part of our cluster. But I specifically remember like some of my friends from photography class being like, oh yeah, let's go to the punk house and like take photos of like some weird like punks. like, oh, somebody's gonna have like a mohawk up or like a fucking huge septum piercing or something like that. And like lo and behold, like the next week, like we're in the dark room and it's like, oh, those are like all like photos of punks. So I think it became like a gathering place for a bunch of like high school weirdos, and then like people who wanted to stick around and do political stuff would do that stuff. I mean, it was weird how it like blended into the punk scene in a way that like I wouldn't consider that a given. Now, I mean, at the time I did kind of think that all punks were anarchists, which is definitely not true.
No,
I survived it for quite a while.
Yeah, such a disappointment when you discover that. Yeah, I suppose there are a few punk bands now where if somebody tells me that they like them, I'm like, oh, that's a knife edge punk band. This could go either way. This person might be very left wing or very right wing. And yeah, I think the Vandals are maybe on that list. There's probably a Vandals to Tradwife desiring pipeline out there.
I would guess there is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Shaking my head.
Just thinking about some of the ideas I had when I was a huge fan of the Vandals, and there's still some Vandal songs I like, and my politics have drastically changed since then. So it's possible. I still like me listening to some Ape Drape. Still a good song.
Yeah.
But yeah, if somebody's if the first band out of their mouth is the Vandals or Screeching Weasel or the Queers or somebody like that, then I'm just kind of like, let's dig a little deeper. I need to know more.
Well, you brought up Rage Against the Machine, and I always, because you know, being older, I was already listening to Osrotten and shit like that,
right?
When Rage got big, so they were, you know, they were talking about stuff that I already knew. So I was like, fuck this poser shit. They're on Sony. I don't care.
Yeah.
But like hearing that they inspired you to look into politics and stuff like that.
So yeah, you can be on a big label and still keep it real-ish.
Like I look back on it now and I'm like, oh, whoa, like rap rock, new metal. Like, oh, I feel, I feel like this category of music didn't turn out like great, you know, like, or it's associated with like a particular kind of like angry white man kind of, it's got a bit of a bad rap, unfortunately, but I definitely found myself drawn to the politics as much as the music. And like, I found it really interesting reading about, like, there was a point where the singer, Zach De La Rocca, did, I'm going to get deep into the Rage lore here, where they were required by Sony to put out a second album, which was, it became Evil Empire. But Zach was like volunteering in Chiapas at the time and required Sony to like send an infusion of cash to the Zapatistas in order for him to return back to Los Angeles to finish the album. And I remember thinking at the time when I was reading it, like, I think that this was kind of the way that the article was painted. It was like, oh, you're a bit of a diva. You're a bit of a diva. You're like making your record company do that. And now in hindsight, I'm like, no, that's great. That's great.
No, that's
great.
Cool.
Good for you. Yeah. Making that happen. And, they've got the money.
Right.
Yeah. Their first record came out before I knew a ton of stuff. So I guess I learned about Leonard Peltier from that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. On the first album, the last song is about Leonard Peltier. And I remember, when I moved to Lawrence, I was like, oh, there's like a lot of Leonard Peltier stuff that is organized in this area. And then, it was somebody from Leavenworth who told me, they're like, he's in Fort Leavenworth and the organizing committee is in this area. But part of my family, it's so weird how like different punk scenes, people will listen to different things. So like my Canadian punk friends and network was all kind of like Fat Records and like skate punk. And like punk you would listen to while you're like fucking riding a dirt bike, you know, like that's like a part of the cult. It's like a part of the West Coast culture up here to like listen to I don't know how else to say it other than like Epitaph and fast paced, poppy, like high energy stuff. And then like moving to Lawrence is like, oh, this is all like crusty and like withered and dark and like deeply political, but like also like maybe a little up its own ass in terms of like like how much we're gonna talk about, like, I can't remember if it was like Axiom who like had this long screed about the death of irony, but it was like interesting stuff.
Little
did they know 9/11 was about to happen and we were about to have a whole new era of irony.
there was
a little bit of crossover but not much. Like I would say like Propagandhi was probably a band that like both crews of my friends listened to. I respect the fact that Propagandhi has come up during this show because I do feel like it's monumental that they were supposed to play in Lawrence on September 11th. Yeah. Like that was a weird old day that we all had.
So fucked.
Yeah.
And then we were standing out in front of the bottleneck and we all went back to the Pirate House and it was just very. Yeah, it was a weird energy in the air. Some people were really upset. Some people were joking around. Like it had not fully settled in what was going on.
We had a bunch of people come over to our house too.
Yeah, because we were supposed to go to that show.
The Pirate House.
No, we went back to the annex. You were freaking out.
Me?
I remember that. Yeah. You were. Yeah. You were like, you were saying that we were all going to get drafted into the army and
it was fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a wild time. I feel like somebody already brought this up, but so I used to go to the Lawrence Farmers Market with my mom. We would like sell produce and jam and stuff there. And I remember like the Saturday after September 11th, some fucking knuckleheads in the back of a pickup truck full of jerry cans like burned into the parking lot and they were like, the price of gas is going up. Like you need to get to a gas station now. And we're all just like, huh? Like my tractor trailer's backed in, like I'm not going any, there's people everywhere, like none of us are going anywhere. And then it came out like later that day that like price gouging was happening all over the place and that people were paying twice as much, maybe three times as much as like what gas was supposed to cost. And
gas back then was like 99 cents a gallon. And somebody, I remember that quick shop by Dylan's on Mass Street, like 19th.
Didn't it go up to like 50 or
like
something.
$5. $5. Yeah. It was fucking crazy.
That's 2001 $5. That's not today $5 too. So it's a lot of money back then.
Yeah, yeah, I think I had a 1986 Cutlass sedan, and that car ran on $5 of fuel at a time.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It never had more than Caddy. Like, it never had more than like a 20th of a tank. And it was around that time too that I think we didn't really have a lot of skinheads in town at the time, but there was like one skinhead who would come to shows. And like, he showed up at the Pirate House shortly after 9/11, I think pretty drunk, and like beating the shit out of the porch with a baseball bat. And like, he needed to be talked down. There was something else going on too. There was some personal beef as well, but it was like one of the first times.
Right?
No, he wasn't. No, he wasn't.
Just one of the, trads that lived up there.
Like if, yeah, like not racist, but like we should go and kill all of the people in the Middle East. Still. Yeah. But like before 9/11, I didn't know any of those opinions that he had. But like, no, it was like one of the first moments where I was like, oh, right. Like this is a big fucking moment. And like some people may come out surprising you in terms of like how they're gonna act. I definitely remember KU games being like pretty horrific. People would like burn like Osama bin Laden effigies and like hang them from nooses off of the back of their trucks and stuff. Like, it was, what a time to be alive.
Yeah. It was a huge cultural shift. Yeah. I mean, I remember it shifting pretty dramatically. I come from a military family. Like, everybody in my family, well, all the men in my family have been in the military. So, I mean, even then, like, a huge cultural shift there of, you know, everybody, you know, doing the, like, you got to do your part type of, you know, talk of, you know, and lots of casual xenophobia and racism kind of lobbed at anything perceived to be Middle Eastern, to include anything Indian, Pakistani, Central Asian. I mean, they're not big on studying geography. So, you know, it was just all kind of lumped in together. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you see that with, I mean, even the Borat movies, nobody knows where the fuck Kazakhstan is.
Right.
Or why they filmed in Romania, which is nowhere fucking near Kazakhstan.
Yeah, I remember at that time a bunch of us being into Mr. Show and like watching a couple of episodes of Mr. Show that felt like they were very of that moment, just like, I don't know, like we're just all going insane with patriotism right now, and this is just going to be our world for a little bit, and like maybe the humor needs to be a little dark because that's what's allowed, you know. It was definitely a moment there where it was not considered acceptable to even like have an anti-war stance or suggest that the country shouldn't be at war. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't really know how else to be.
I've been anti-war my whole life. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I remember, you know, even Desert Storm, I was like, this is terrible. Why do we care what happens here? This is not our business. But then, 9/11 happened, and I was like, this is going to be really fucking shitty. And it was even shittier than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
12 plus years.
Well, and it was weird. I saw even people I knew on the left back then, or who at least I thought were, maybe they were, maybe they weren't, I don't know. Like I said, I was super apolitical, so I was just like, I don't give a fuck, man. Just want to drink, whatever, watch bands play. But yeah, I remember people who were at least perceived to be on the left who, over a few years, just completely shifted and are just, even to this day, are just absolute right-wing chuds now. And I just think, like, my God, what the... A lot of Gen Xers, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And then I shifted the opposite direction, oddly enough. And that's when I started discovering things, you know, Rage Against the Machine is how I first heard about the Zapatistas too. It's funny that you said that, Nicole, because like, I was like,
oh, interesting.
Oh yeah. That's the first time I heard of them. And I was like, what's that? And then when I lived in the UK, one of my buddies there who was, you know, an anarchist outside of London for years, you know, he was the one who kind of was like, hey, let's talk about the Zapatistas and let me explain it to you. And that's when I found out what they were all about. And that's really when my politics, you know, I kind of went dim sock for a long time and then shifted even further from there.
Yeah, I felt like we were all in like an anti-globalization moment until 9/11, and then everything became about war and discussions kind of shifted in a way that felt like you can only have really rudimentary conversations in public places now. There's all of these stories of people's protests getting shut down, or it just becoming feeling really high stakes to protest for a bit. And like, I actually wanted to mention that too. I felt like that was kind of a through line with some of the organizing in Lawrence, was that like there were different people who were involved in different big protests at different times who had been like traumatized by their like violent arrests or by their treatment by the police. And like, I think I have more of an appreciation for that now in terms of looking at like maybe like people who drank a lot or people who like weren't doing so hot in the time that I knew them. It's like, oh, well, you were dealing with a lot. You were dealing with charges, or you were dealing with trauma, or an ongoing lawsuit that doesn't go away, you know.
Wasn't the FBI involved somehow with some people who were involved in activism up there? I don't want to name names or anything, but there was like some serious shit for hanging on some people. If I remember right.
In Lawrence?
Yeah. I think from when everybody went up to Seattle, I think there was some shit that went down in Seattle that got people
in trouble. Okay.
And I think that a couple people had some like FBI shit hanging on them or something. I don't know for sure. This is like vague memories of discussions people were having, but I feel like there were a handful of people that got in some shit from doing some of their activism and arrests.
I feel like that's like slightly before my time, but it's reminding me that this was one of the things that I thought about mentioning, is how so many people I knew in Lawrence would disappear and go to Oregon like a period of time and then come back. It just felt like a thing that kept happening to people I knew, where I'd be like, oh, who, where's so-and-so? Oh, they like moved to Eugene and they'll be back in 6 months. And going to Eugene in the last couple of years, I like met a couple of people from Lawrence. I was like, oh, there's like still maybe a pipeline between these two lefty like college towns. I don't know. I just thought it was kind of an interesting idea that like there's a little bit of the Pacific Northwest in Lawrence. And I saw that. I saw that in the politics, like for sure, with like Crime Think, with Crust Punk.
There's a lot of people in there's a lot of Lawrence people in Portland and Seattle.
I
remember Dylan, so I lived with Dylan at the Pirate House. Dylan lives in Seattle now.
Brandon, I don't know if you remember Brandon. Brandon might have been before your time.
I think so. The name rings a bell, but I don't.
He was in Derailleur and Wormwood and shit.
Right.
He's in Portland now, isn't he? He's in Portland?
No, he's in Seattle.
Oh, Seattle. Okay. Dylan moved Dylan's in Tacoma actually now. I think he left Seattle because it got too expensive. Nick Mayo is still in Seattle. I saw him. I lived in Seattle. Well, I lived outside of Seattle for 2 years. Just moved back a year ago.
Right. Chris is in Portland. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right. Corinne is in Portland. She was somebody I went to school with who did anti-war organizing, anarchist organizing with. I'm actually just thinking about shows, different shows that I saw over the years. And I wanted to give you all a piece of feedback. I was like listening to the podcast with a friend, and we were talking about how the podcast needs samples of songs from bands that are local. And I don't have access to that. I don't know how to get access to that, but I know somebody out there has has the necessary recordings to like make that happen.
But yeah,
like
Brandon sent me Wormwood, Misanthrope, and Derailleur stuff. And our intro and outro is SBK. So we do have that. But
and we'd have access to anything Joe or Jonna has ever done because they're frequent listeners and we are in regular communication with them. So
and I think we got some Killed in the Face.
recordings. Are there recordings of Killed in the Face? I was trying to remember good shows, like shows that I remembered. Unfortunately, I missed the Faint show, but I remember getting a copy of the Faint record from a kid at high school. He was you should check this out. I was like, I've been hearing about these guys. And he hooked me up with a CD. I think one of the first shows I saw was Severed Head Estate. And there was also a matinee show that was one of my first shows. And like, memory may or may not serve me here, but I remember like Laszlo, maybe just like unplugging the sound every 5 to 10 minutes because it was like a really packed light up. And so everybody got to play for like 5 to 10 minutes. but it was a matinee show, a great idea. There was like bands there from out of town and it was just like really fun and festive. And I'm pretty sure it was at that show that somebody played a cover of 7 Seconds Young Until I Die. I feel like it was Jesse Heckman's band, but I don't know what band Jesse Heckman was in. And I remember that being like super, super fun. Mm. That was a great show. Sufi Nun Squad was probably another one of my favorites.
Fuck yeah. You're so much fun.
And I've got a weird like tangent about Sufi Nun Squad. So I saw them in Kansas City first, and while I was watching like the band before them, I went up to like a merch table where Nate Powell was tabling with his comic Walkie Talkie, and I was like, "What is this? Like, these are they're punk comics? Like, what you make these?" And like, I'm 15 at the time, and I'm just like, "This is the coolest fucking thing I've ever seen, like these DIY punk comics." And now lo and behold, I make comics professionally, and I ran into Nate at the Toronto Comic Arts Festival like 12 years ago. He was there with a new book that he had written called, well, he hadn't written it, he had illustrated it, called March, which is like a graphic biography of John Lewis, who was like a civil rights organizer and congressperson who has since passed, but his story is like a unique. Yeah, his story is incredible. Like, and the artwork is just amazing. Like, if you ever saw Walkie Talkie, Nate's work is still that beautiful, but it's just gotten better. Like, I just ordered this one. I don't know if you guys can see this, but it's
That's really cool.
It's a book he did about parenting and like bringing up your kids to care about the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, his art is just so cool, and I only know about him because of Sufi Nun Squad, so nice. I figured I would bring up Nate Powell and like how much he inspired me.
That's awesome.
But those shows, like aside from Nate's comics, those shows were amazing. I mean, y'all remember Sufi Nun Squad, right?
Yeah.
Like the
I worked
costumes
with him when I lived
the dances
in Kansas City.
Really? Oh, okay. I thought they were all from Arkansas,
yeah. Right.
Yeah. He was going to school at the Art Institute, though. So while he was at school, he worked at Wild Oats.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Makes sense.
Me. So, and he had like one semester left when I worked there. So we didn't work together a long time, but he was super rad.
Mm-hmm.
So fun.
That reminds me of another thing where you guys were talking about punk jobs in Lawrence and how somehow there were so many jobs for punks in Lawrence. I wanted to add one of my jobs to the list. I worked for ECM up on campus, the Ecumenical Christian Ministries Church, and I painted banners for them. So I was like a banner painter for their like visiting lecture series.
That I
inherited from another art school student at LHS. So nice. It's like painting banners all the fucking time. But Oh, and they still house half of the library from the Solidarity Center. I don't know if y'all are going to have somebody in who can talk about Solidarity, but that I think that started the year that I left and went up to Canada for school. But the library that was started by the Mother Earth Collective and then was inherited by the Black Cat Collective then went to Solidarity. So,
oh, cool.
And I used to volunteer in that library. I look back on it now. I'm like, thank fucking God we actually had real librarians involved in this library, because it was like relatively well organized, but it was still quite funny. Like the donations of books that we would get and like seeing the ways that books would be organized. And there was like an Ayn Rand pile where it was like people donated Ayn Rand books. They like go in a little box under the desk.
Yeah.
Right.
For a donation to somewhere else or.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd burn them later.
just put them in the bathroom for toilet paper.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that reminds me of another. That reminds me of a story at Rainbow House. Somebody fucking I went to the bathroom during a show or a party there, and like there was writing above the toilet paper roll that said, "You are allowed to use two squares of toilet paper. Don't keep clogging up our toilet. This is like, people live here." And then right underneath that, scrawled in somebody's writing who I did recognize, it was like, "Rainbow House equals 1923 Stalinist Russia."
Well, we'll have to have Brooke on and ask about that or something. Or Jamie lives up here in Chicago now.
I hadn't hung out there very much. I limited myself mostly to shows at the Byron House, but that one stands out in my mind for sure.
Yeah.
How long did you live at the Pirate House, or did you actually live there?
So I moved in like, I want to say May or June, kind of, sort of 2000. Like, I mean, I was 16, so I was like technically living with my mom, but my mom lived out of town, and you know, if I stayed at the Pirate House, I would be walking distance to my high school. So, and it's like, I'm going to shows and like hanging out with people. It was actually, it was really great. But now in hindsight, I'm like, did I pay rent? did I ever pay rent while I was at the Pirate House?
Did anyone?
If anybody wants to clarify whether or not I paid rent,
I can ask Joe.
Apparently I was one of those kinds of anarchists. I remember by the time I left Lawrence, I had a joke going with a couple of people that crime think was a verb. And I'm not sure if this is funny to you two, or if you'd been around the crime think folks enough to, but the idea that like, hey, can I crime think your couch for a few days? Like, hey, can I crime think the rest of that coffee?
Right.
It's like, oh, like, can you allow this person to just like mooch and you not be upset about it? Yeah, that was what that meant. I wanted to provide any clarifying information about the North American Anarchist Gathering. I feel like that's been brought up a few times, but like, I don't know if it was given that title.
I didn't remember what it was called.
It was June of 2022, and yeah, you mentioned the dance party that happened in
town.
That wouldn't have been
June 22, because no? Nick and I were already out of our house at that point. I want to say it, because it was right before Neckbone moved to Lawrence, so it would have been like,
was that when I was still in St. Louis?
Yeah, it would have been like April or May 2001.
Okay. That was right before I moved there. It was like a month or two before I moved there then. Yeah.
I wonder what was going on then. There was a bit of a Kansas anarchist gathering initiative that first year. Mm-hmm. And then we all gassed each other up and said, we should do like a continental thing. Fuck, we're in the center of the continent. And then somehow we spent the next 8 months organizing this gathering of 600 people that came to camp at Clinton Lake, which was fun. It was fun, but it was, it was kind of wild.
There were workshops like all day Saturday, and then everybody showed up at Justin in my house, and we just had impromptu dance party. My girlfriend at the time was basically the DJ, and there was like 100 kids in my house dancing to 80s music. And I mean, it was packed, and there were people on the stairs, and it was bananas.
So good.
It was so much fun, though.
I'm trying to remember like the most monumental of like parties and shows. I definitely wanted to bring up the Locust show, because I felt like that was
Still really mad I missed that.
It sounds like you barely missed it, or like maybe you heard it down the street.
Well, it was I was walking toward the show 12 pack in hand when I saw all the cop cars, and then I just did I seriously did like an about face movement and walked right back to the annex, and I was like, nope, not dealing with that.
yeah I feel like my recounting of it is like they played for like 11 minutes and then the cops showed up.
6 minutes.
Was it 6 minutes? Okay.
The
cops showed up. We tell them, you know, that's it. We got to wrap up. And they were like, that was our set. Like, we're done. That was it. And then they left the next day, and somebody, I think the drummer, forgot his like Locust reflector vest. And I got to wear it. I got to put it on my body. And then he came back and he was like, I forgot that. I was like, fuck. It would have been the best, memento after a show. But no, I mean, that's too valuable for them.
Did you happen to go out to Clinton Lake with us and go swimming?
Yeah. Oh, I forgot. Was that the Locust show? I do remember. Yeah. I do remember going out there. I remember that was a really fun night. That was like a whole crew of people. I remember it being a pretty regular thing after shows, like depending on whether or not the band was down, but just to like make up like a big stir fry and everybody eats. Mm-hmm. That was always like one of the nicest parts of the show, was like after the music stops and everybody can just like hang out. And you would never know from a band who was gonna be nice and who was gonna be like a shithead asshole. Like I remember this one metal band played, and like their music was super doomy, and then like talking to the singer afterwards, I was like, oh, you're like so, you're so nice, you're so kind, you know, like you are super friendly, you're like super excited about vegan stir fry, this is awesome. We would also, I think, pretty regularly end up at Perkins too, if I'm not mistaken, because it was 24 hours and they had vegan latkes, so that kept people coming back for more.
I remember Leslie hosted a meal for Total Chaos.
They were
super nice guys.
What you were saying.
She was just going on about how nice they were, and I was like, oh, that's really sweet.
It almost makes me feel bad for thinking their band sucks now.
Yeah, I mean, some of those bands were like total sweeties, and it ended up becoming, I don't know, like I moved to another punk venue when I lived in Toronto, like I want to say 10 years ago now, and it wasn't a punk house. It was like, we called it a punk house, but it wasn't a punk house. It was like a hardcore loft. It's like a different thing. No porch, you know, no living room, but like apartments in the back and shows in the front. And I just remember thinking, I'm like, oh, these shows aren't as friendly as I remember shows being in Lawrence. Like there was something that was really personable about the shows that would happen. And when I moved and went to shows in other cities, it's like, I could see that, like, yeah, there's some of that, but you lose some of it too, the personal.
As far as I know, maybe I was too old when I moved here, but like, they just don't have house shows in Chicago. Everything's a venue. And there are all age venues, and there's a lot of all age venues, but like, every time you go watch a show, you're paying to go in, but you're paying like the venue. You're not just handing money to the band directly. Where the people who like live in the house, like help them pay bills and stuff. It's like, no, you have to, and you're expected to spend money while you're there too. Even if it's just like buying sodas and stuff. There's all kinds of things I love about living in a big, huge city But I do miss, yeah, how like personal somewhere like Lawrence is when you go to shows. And even that show I went to in Champaign, despite the fact that they had no floor in their basement, it was just dirt. And I thought the whole house was about to collapse, and that guy tried to get me to smoke crack with him. It was still a good time, you know?
Oh, what show did you go to in Champaign?
I wish I knew. This was in like 08, maybe. Okay. So it was a long time ago. And someone just dragged me to Champaign. They're like, you want to go see a show in Champaign? I was like, sure. And right. Went down there, went to the, I used to live in the Central House in Kansas City, which is probably, even Joe said it was maybe the worst house he'd ever lived in. And that dude lived in the Flanders House and the Pirate House. Right. So that's, I feel like he would know.
Those houses have had highs and they've had lows. Yeah.
But this
did
house
the Flanders in Champaign, have highs?
Did just had lows. Maybe when folks moved in, I don't know. I remember Joe going over there for the first time from high school, and like you walk in the front door and it's like a big fucking PETA poster of a bear without fur. And it's like, that's the first fucking thing you're seeing when you come into this house is a bear without
fur.
That's
the cold open of the house.
Well, I don't know if I feel that welcome here. This feels a little hostile.
That's actually the vibe at the Flanders House, even though I knew everybody there, it always did feel like a little unwelcoming.
This is what they mean by hostile architecture, is like right. What the Flanders House felt like when you were in it. No, and there were good shows there though. Yeah. I don't remember any of them, but
State of Fear show was playing. Real good, and the Against Me shows were real good.
Mm-hmm. I missed the Against Me shows, I'm really sorry to say. I did see them in a basement in Kansas City when Reinventing Axl Rose came out. Mm-hmm. I remember.
I was at that show, yep.
That was a fun show. Yeah, I remember they sang Lowell Happy Birthday, which I thought was really, really cute.
Yeah.
And it was introduced as like a historic working class ballad. And then they like launched into Happy Birthday. I remember I met William S. Burroughs's gardener at a punk show.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that's just like weird shit that Lawrence would do.
We used to go to parties at James Gowerholt's house, who was his.
It was William S. Burroughs' house. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I went to school with his grandson. I just realized that. I went to school with his fucking grandson. And I remember one day at lunch, he came out and he was like, hey, check this out. And it was like a 50-cent piece shot through, like with a bullet.
Nice.
So like JFK's head is exploding. Oh. Uh-huh. And I remember just being like, yeah, whatever. Like you're fucking, you're from like an art weirdo family. Like, of course you have that in your pocket. Right. a little jealous. I feel like I have to bring up something ridiculous that happened at the Pirate House. So somebody at a show showed up with a hamster in each pocket of their hoodie and like took them to Dave, and they were like, these hamsters were going to get fed to a snake at the pet store, and I felt bad, and so I stole them, but I can't keep them. I live with my parents and I can't keep them. Can they stay at the Pirate House? And like, of course, Dave is like, yes, we'll take the hamsters. And sure enough, within like a week, they had been put in the same cage and they had started to reproduce. So now there are six hamsters. And like, to me in my mind, this is like something that happens over a period of days, but it must not have been, because there was a pregnancy involved. Like, this hamster had baby hamsters, so this must have been something that was going on for months, and my brain just like doesn't remember it that way. But like, sure enough, Dave names each of the six hamsters after a famous anarchist. So there's there's Emma, there's Sabo, there's Machno. Like all of these hamsters. And like, I remember at one random point, like a fucking joke that like goes away for a few episodes and then comes back around, like something was happening at the Pirate House, and then like Dave is like weaving through the house being like, Sabo got out of his cage. And wait, so there's like a hunt to find the hamsters.
Could he tell them apart?
They were different colors.
Oh, okay. Okay. It's like how did he know who was who?
Yeah. So I felt like I needed to like give a shout out to the anarchist hamsters of the pirate house that lived once upon a time. And then like the last thing that I had in my list was I wanted to like question you guys about Canadian bands and gauge whether you know of some of the most famous Canadian punk bands. I feel like you guys would, but I just like, I just like grabbed a list and I'm wondering, okay, so Propagandhi, Submission Hold.
Yeah. Submission Hold. They played at the Pirate House.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. So they're from Vancouver and I saw them when I moved to Vancouver. I was like, oh, I feel like I know this band. Maybe it's because I saw them in Lawrence. I don't know.
Yeah.
Godspeed You Black Emperor / Silver Mount Zion. They're from Montreal. Mm-hmm. Avril Lavigne, the founder of punk rock.
Who? Wait, no, I've never. She's a little too obscure for me.
Yeah. that's a deep cut there. Yeah.
That was like one of the last things that I was thinking of bringing up was going to see the Buzzcocks on their reunion tour at the Bottleneck. Mm-hmm. Were either of you guys at that show?
No, I would have loved to go.
It was fun. Oh, that was like 2003, I want to say. But they had an opener that they were apparently super stoked about. And they were like, we're really excited about these guys. They're new, like they're interesting. And like, we want you to give them a big welcome. And, like, keep in mind, like the audience is like Buzzcocks fans. Like they're people who are older than me, their dad's drinking beer. And this band comes out and it's Billy Talent. You guys know about Billy Talent?
Yeah.
I feel like Billy Talent is like the Avril Lavigne of like punk bands. Like kind of engineered and like mainstream and poppy, but like the Buzzcocks were like totally behind them. And I was just very, everybody in the audience was like, what the fuck's going on? I don't know. All of these things somehow all happened in the same amount of time. Going to the farmer's market, seeing the guy from the Get Up Kids at the farmer's market, he would be there with his kids. Lawrence was just a weird place.
Yeah.
These things just happened.
It's the crossroads everybody travels through there.
Jesse Camp from MTV was hanging out there for like 3 months. And then the youngest kid from Home Improvement was there.
Home Improvement! We were waiting in the same movie theater line to go see Fellowship of the Ring. And I remember we were all like, yo, that's the dude from Home Improvement.
Yeah, he hung out there for a while. I don't know what he was doing. I never interacted with him. I never saw him. I heard he was around a lot.
Lawrence is a weird town. I mean, Lawrence is the only, you know, especially considering how small it is and how few people really know about it. I mean, it is one of those places where you can miss out on going to a KU game because Paul Rudd got the last fucking ticket. Like, and you're like, Paul fucking Rudd? Really? You're like, oh yeah, there's a lot of people who have been connected to that town. I mean, a lot of it is because of the university.
There's an Onion article or maybe a Hard Times article that mentions Lawrence, and it's like about how like a roadie got forgotten in Lawrence, and so he's like, well, I'm just gonna make a go of it here.
I'm pretty sure that's Hard Times.
And it's like, that is almost the truth.
It's
almost what happens.
That's how I got half of my roommates. It's just like somebody who just ended up there. They're like, I need a place to live. And I was like, cool, need a roommate.
I'll give it a try. Go ask for a job at the soy factory.
What was your experience like in the scene? Do you feel like you were treated well? Do you feel like it was welcoming, or did you have any negative experiences?
I was thinking about this recently because I feel like some people knew me as Dave's girlfriend, which was interesting because like I also like hung out with a crew of people from my high school who didn't know Dave. So it's like easily in any circumstance in the punk scene, like maybe people know me from like school, or maybe people just know me as like by association, like I'm somebody who's at the Pirate House or I'm involved in anarchist organizing. But like on the whole, I felt like people were really fucking friendly and funny. Like it was a very, very funny, positive scene to be a part of. You know, despite maybe being known to some people as like, you know, so-and-so's girlfriend, like I actually didn't feel like that was the case very much. Like a lot of women that I knew and hung out with in the scene were not just there because they were dating somebody. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like people were there, they were screen printing, or they were in bands, or they were doing their own organizing, or, you know, whatever. Like that definitely wasn't, that wasn't the feeling. So I don't know, like I don't totally know what to compare it to, but it was definitely like my, I want to say like entry point for like a sense of community in a couple of ways, like political, art, culture, that I was super fucking happy to have in my, like once I was going through my 20s. And like, I'm moving to new places and other friend groups are falling apart. And, you know, it was like, oh shit, like that was actually something really special. Like the ability to have had such a vibrant and diverse kind of scene where like so many people were doing so much, so many different things, you know, like lots of people had different things that they cared about or different projects or different like styles or senses of humor that they would bring to different events and stuff. Like it was just, it was great. It was great. And it definitely reminded me at other times in my life that like that kind of community can even happen for sure. Like, well, especially in big cities where it just feels like there's a constant churn of people.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, for the amount of people that were involved between all the punk houses there, people got on along surprisingly well. I mean, there was drama here and there, but for the most part, there was nothing. There was no real big fallouts, at least while I was there. I mean, I didn't get along with some people, but it was never super contentious and like,
yeah,
and hang out at a party with them and not feel unwelcome, or, you know, they didn't feel unwelcome around me. We would give each other shit in a playful way, and that was about it, you know.
Yeah.
Which I feel for that many people is pretty good. It could easily have been much more toxic than it was. I mean, that's what I experienced in a lot of other music scenes since then, is you know, not the camaraderie that we had in Lawrence.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely feel like the tension that did exist, it definitely falls more into the category of like shenanigans.
Yeah.
You know, like I, having dated Dave, I know a lot of people fucking loved to piss Dave off. Like, loved it. You know what?
It was fun.
Yeah.
Because it was fucking funny.
Yeah, we did it a lot. Yeah.
I remember one time we came back from like a weekend visiting his mom in Leavenworth, and like the Pirate House was fucking trashed. Like all of the furniture had been turned upside down. Somebody, yeah, like actually had taken the time to like turn a couch 100% upside down. Somebody had taken turtle wax and left a little swirl of turtle wax on all of the doorknobs in the Pirate House. Like fucking rough stuff happened that weekend. And you know, like, yeah, Dave's walking through the house and like, I swear to God, guys, he took off his cap and he threw it on the ground. Which is just like, you know, I feel like people would pay money to see that now.
Yeah.
One time, oh man, one time he came back from, I'm only mentioning this because I know that like, Dave is proud of his Civil War reenacting. Dave's a Civil War reenactor.
I knew that.
And
Joe told me all about it.
Takes it quite seriously. And I remember he came back from like an event on the weekend and he was pissed. He was like grumpy about something. And I can't remember if I found out the truth from like his buddy who went with him or him, but it turned out that he was so pissed because at the reenactment, there were people who were not in character. They were not acting like it was the Civil War. There were fucking kids there with balloons.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy selling hot dogs, and it just fucking ruined it. We all had a good laugh at the time, but like, I look,
yeah,
I love him.
I'm only bringing it up because it's like a fond memory.
Yeah.
But like, I look back on that now, and I'm just like, this was the tensest that I felt like it got. You know, yeah. It's like,
well, I'm sorry, yeah, his Civil War got ruined by that hot dog vendor.
Yeah, no, it was a remarkably harmonious scene, I want to say. And I look back on so many of those memories super fondly. And I'm so happy that y'all have this podcast, because I feel like different people remember different things, mm-hmm, and different people have random funny stories about walking down Kentucky in their underwear at 12 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And Leslie's house has a bunch of girls on the porch, and you can just like hear them all screaming because these guys are walking down the street in their underwear. I'm not going to mention who that was. Yeah. I will say that this person also, on their birthday, we were walking down the hill from KU, and they picked up a cinder block and just fucking threw it into somebody's windshield.
Oh, nice.
Like, it's your fucking birthday.
Yeah. Wait, was that me?
No. Well, if you want me to tell you if it was you?
Somebody threw, this was in Westport. I was walking down the street with somebody, and we had been drinking, but we were just walking back from the bar. And they, same thing, they picked up a brick that they found, and they just threw it through like a store window. And I was just like, fuck. And I just like, so I just ran, because I was living at the Central House, which was down the street. And I was like, I'm going fucking home. Jeez, because an alarm went off too. And I was like, nope, I'm out of here.
Oh, fuck my God. Shit,
yeah. So I'm not.
There was a 2-week period where at the Boston apartments, the Central House kids were throwing eggs at cars as they drove by. Mm-hmm. I don't fucking know why. They were just drunk and decided to throw eggs at cars driving by. So they're off doing that, and I'm alone in my apartment. I like went up to my apartment to get my beer or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a fucking helicopter shows up and is like shining lights in all the apartments because people were freaked out about getting eggs thrown at them. So like, I've got all the lights off. I'm laying on the floor and there's a spotlight coming at me. I'm like, oh, what the fuck? There's fucking cops coming.
Are you gonna ask Nicole the most important question? Yeah. Should I?
I was
okay.
First, thank you for agreeing to come on and
share stuff
with us. It's great. We love doing the podcast and having friends come on and share memories with us. It's really great. But the most important question we have for you is, which side of the shit split is the better side?
Was this covered in the latest episode? I'm like at a loss.
The filth flats shit split.
Yeah.
I don't know what this is. Our first third category.
Oh no. Oh no.
What is this? She made
it into the third category.
You're our first poser.
Oh, I'm definitely a poser. I have no fucking idea what this is.
So it's the filth flats split album that came out in the 90s. Yeah.
Oh no, I never heard that one. No. Oh, okay. I'm the secret third option of poser. Oh, yeah, wow. For sure. Yeah,
there's three types of punks in the world. Filth punks, blats punks, and posers.
Yeah.
So congratulations on being our first poser. I'm so stoked.
If you want to listen to it and then go ahead and hop on the blats side, because we need more people.
The minority.
Wasn't the
poll earlier like a spaz split 7-inch? Or I feel like
we did Grimple
and Logical Nonsense.
Logical Nonsense.
Another one.
Was it? Yeah. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. No. Poser. Mm-hmm. Definitely a poser. Yeah.
First, third category. All right. Finally.
Yeah, that's me.
19 episodes and we finally hit the third category.
But I will definitely give it a listen. I'd love to hear y'all's little 7-inch. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have you back so you can do an update and hopefully. Uh-huh. come onto the Blatt side. So it's not just, who is it now? Just, it's just like me and Joe or something, isn't it?
No,
Joe's filled.
It's me, you, and Thule.
That's it. Okay. Everyone else is filled.
Three of us.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. By the way, Patrick from last episode did send us links to his movies, and we need to watch
those.
Yeah,
I want to watch those.
Back to him. So, Patrick, if you're listening, we will get back to you about those movies.
And then I will also get you my script for 50 Shades of Gary. So,
yeah, nice.
Yeah. It'll
be good. Have y'all played Suburbia yet? Have you, the old one?
Both of them.
Yeah. All right. Good. Gotta check it out.
You gotta check out our
bonus movie review. That bonus content.
Do you want to talk about what you do now?
Yeah. And, do you want to plug your
comics?
I can do that. Yeah.
And talk about how you got started and what you do, and just basically, go nuts, whatever you want.
Okay. When I was in Lawrence and I was in high school, I was like super into art, so I was pretty sure I wanted to go do something in art. Really interested in activism and organizing. So I felt like if I could do something to blend those two, and sure enough, it took me a while to come around to it. But now my job is I'm a comic book illustrator, and I mostly work with really badass scholars to disseminate their research into comics. Or I'll work with like nonprofits or unions. I'm working on a comic about a grad student union right now. So I feel like I kind of won the job lottery. I started out publishing comics, and I formed a press called Ad Astra Comics, which like people in Kansas know about Ad Astra per Aspera, but nobody in Canada. They're like, what is this? What does this mean? And I need to explain to them that I'm from Kansas and like it's kind of a thing.
What's Ontario's motto? Does Ontario have a motto?
Oh man.
Oh no.
I'm right. Quebec's on the other side of the river, and so I know Quebec is Je me souviens, like remember me, but oh man, Yours to Discover, is that it?
Fuck. Oh okay.
So lame.
Yeah. It can just be like, let's kick out Jordan Peterson. That can be the
Yours to Discover. Yeah, Jordan Peterson is Yours to Discover. Do your own research. Yeah, he was or still is a professor at University of Toronto somehow.
And it's also wild. Dresses,
stopped eating just meat.
There are also dresses like the Joker so now, like,
for some reason.
Oh, interesting. Oh, yeah. I didn't see that one coming. I should like have the seen Joaquin that one
Phoenix
coming.
Joker. Yeah.
I just saw that movie. I would highly recommend it.
The second one.
Yeah, it's it's fascinating. I mean, we're not going to go into it here, but you know, lots to say about it. I was just going to comment on how it is weird that there are so many right-wing media pundits that are actually from Canada, but Canada is considered like a more progressive place on the whole.
Yeah, you've got Lauren Southern, Jordan Peterson, Gavin McGinnis.
That's right.
Who is unfortunately also Scottish, that bastard. There's good Scotsmen out there, I promise. We've got most of the Kids in the Hall, damn it.
Oh, yeah. Kids in the Hall. Definitely. Where did you hear about Kids in the Hall?
TV.
It's like one of those Canadian standards, but I don't know where Americans hear about them.
I used to work at Videomania in Kansas City. And we had, everything was bootleg. Every bootleg you could find. So we had all the Kids in the Hall episodes. We had all the Mr. Show episodes. We had basically everything. Everything in the Criterion Collection, all kinds of like random, like we had a lot of like LGBTQ, like queer representation. I mean, Videomania, obviously, was owned by a gay man, so it makes sense. But so we had a lot of like indie, one of them was Kids in the Hall. And we watched every episode top to bottom like 50 times. So
holy shit. Yeah. Wow. I got to run, guys. This was amazing. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Oh, yeah. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, have a good night, and I look forward to listening to this, but also catching up on the other 5 episodes that I haven't heard first.
and the punk movie review as well. All 4
yes,
of them.
I definitely need, I've been waiting for that, so got to catch up. Okay, I'll talk to you guys later. Thanks so much.
Thanks, bye-bye. All right,
thanks.
Bye.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening. Don't forget to visit our website at www.prairiepunkpress.com. Please visit it on all of our social media platforms. We are on Facebook. We are on YouTube. We are on Instagram. And what else are we on?
Threads.
Threads. That's right.
And it, kind of on X.
We have an account. We will not check it. Twitter. I highly encourage everybody to delete their X account.
Fuck Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Fuck Twitter. It's
really hopefully. Gross. Yeah, Twitter.
Did you hear he's given away $1 million to people that agree to like register to vote or something weird?
Oh yeah, it's people to sign a petition saying that they will defend the Second Amendment or the First Amendment. Well, not the First Amendment. He doesn't care about that one anymore. The Second Amendment now.
Second Amendment. Yeah.
That's the one he cares about now. Now that he owns enough media, he doesn't have to care about it.
The plutocracy of this country. Yeah. Totally absurd. It's
fucking wild.
What a time to be alive.
Right. So everybody, delete your X account or Twitter account, whichever one you want to call it. Either way, hit that delete button, take it right off of your phone and your computer. And Elon, if you don't like that, you can sue me. I don't give a shit. I don't have anything anyway. But please visit us on our other social media platforms. And don't forget to listen to our other podcast, Punk Movie Review. We're going to have Return of the Living Dead coming up just in time for Halloween. So that one will be released probably on an odd day because it's probably I'm going to try to release it on Halloween or maybe the day before Halloween. We'll see. But that will be the middle of the week. Is that
Thursday?
Yeah, Wednesday or Thursday.
I can't believe October's almost over.
Yeah, that's wild, man. It was the fucking 80 degrees here today and now it's 50 degrees. Yeah.
I'm going to pee and drink some more coffee. And not go to sleep.
Oh. We should. It's late.
I don't wanna.
Okay, we'll stay. Are you gonna game?
Yeah, I'll probably play Star Wars Outlaws for a little while.
Still. Nice.
Still playing that.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.